It's time to look up, and do you know that CRKC is the only radio station in the country with a dedicated astronomy slot? And joining me, as usual, is David Moore, editor of Astronomy Ireland magazine, to talk about humanity's return to the moon, spectacular sights in January, in the January night sky, and some great hands-on events for the public over the coming weeks. A very good evening to you, David.
Good evening, Eugene.
How are you this week?
Very excited. Last minute news, stop press, stop the lights. There could be a major aurora tonight. There's been a big explosion on the sun. We don't know exactly when it's going to hit, but we've found out in the last few hours.
Right, okay. And you'll be able to, when will you know?
The problem with aurora, they're a bit unpredictable. Sometimes they come early if the material hurled from the sun is very fast. And sometimes they come slowly. And sometimes the predictions are off. It's not an exact science. And the cloud of radiation misses the Earth. But this one looks pretty certain. And they're predicting almost the top-level storm. So people may remember, last year before, I'm losing track of time now, that there were two huge auroras in May and October. And this could be one of those. But we'll have to wait and see. Might be happening before midnight, could be at dawn. There's even a chance it could happen during daylight hours in Ireland, and the North Americans and people in Asia get to see it instead. So just keep watching the skies tonight is my tip.
Okay. Now, David, NASA's Artemis program is often described as the biggest step back to the moon since Apollo. From your perspective, what makes Artemis such a major milestone in space exploration?
Oh, it's just so exciting in so many ways. It was December 1972 when the last human set foot on the moon and then left after a few days, never to return. And it's now over 53 years later. So much for progress. We all expected moon bases and regular tourist trips to the moon and things like that. Mm-hmm. It never happened because it was really ahead of its time back in the 60s and 70s. As a political whim that the Americans and the Soviets were in this Cold War space race
yes.
to prove who had the better technology. And the Russians nearly won. They had beaten the Americans on so many fronts, first satellite in space, first human in space, first woman in space, the list got first spacewalk. I've met Alexei Leonov, shook his hand. I've met Neil Armstrong, Buzz Aldrin, shook their hands. So it was all very big in the late 70s, and it fizzled out. Because the public lost interest when Neil Armstrong said those famous words and sort of sealed the deal that the Americans had won. But now the Chinese, and we just found out today, they've announced 2030 as their landing date on the moon. There's another space race on with another communist country. So who knows what's going to happen? Billions are being spent. For once, Donald Trump is behind putting people on the moon during his term in office.
Mm-hmm.
We don't think that's going to deter things. We've had one of the Artemis missions that already swung around the moon, unmanned, just to make sure it all worked, that it could splash down and land safely, which it did. And now we have Artemis 2, which could go up in just a couple of weeks. February the 6th is the first possible launch date, with a crew of four, go around the moon, actually go quite far from the moon when they're on the far side, which would make them the most distant humans ever to leave planet Earth. They won't land, though, and then the next mission, Artemis 3, would land in either next year or the year after. But there's a lot of tests to be done. They rolled out the rocket to the launch pad over the weekend, so it's built. Now they've got to test it, fuel it, put the astronauts on board, light the fuse, and step back.
Okay. Now, the Artemis missions aren't just about landing astronauts again, but about staying on the moon long-term. Why is establishing a sustained human presence on the moon so important scientifically and indeed strategically?
Well, scientifically, there's loads of reasons. One of the big factors is the economics behind it. I mean, it's a bit of a prestige project as well, that the Americans won't be beaten by the Chinese to the moon. But when the USA went to the moon in the 60s and 70s, it did so much for their industry. I think NASA has estimated, I've forgotten it, you hear figures of $3, $5, and $7 per dollar of taxpayers' money that they put into the space program. Because a lot of engineers, young engineers, get trained up on really high-tech things, integrated circuits, the almost trillion transistors. That's a million transistors that's in a good smartphone these days, came from the fact that NASA needed to miniaturize everything. They were a huge customer. I think it was 5% of the entire U.S. federal budget went on NASA during the moonshots era. And that just powered American industry, especially electronics industry, forward. Integrated chips have been around since the 50s, but now look at them. They run so much of our lives today. It's a multi-trillion dollar business. So other young people will be inspired when they see this, you know, reach for the stars attitude. And that has untold benefits on your economy. I think most of the American politicians realize that. The scientists and the industrialists love it. And, of course, the scientific return is we can find out more about where the Earth came from, where the moon came from, do all kinds of science on the moon that you can't do on the Earth with our atmosphere. And also, NASA stated it's a stepping stone to missions to Mars, which are much, much more difficult. Mars is hundreds of times further away.
And speaking of Mars, David, how does returning to the moon help prepare astronauts and technology for future missions deeper into space, such as Mars?
Yeah, it's a proving ground. So if you're going to run a marathon, day one of training, you don't go out and do the 26 miles. You do a short run, see how you get on, turn back as soon as you're tired. And then you build up from there. And it's the same with the moon. You'll have to have a base. You'll be sort of in contact with the Earth. It's about 1.5 seconds for a radio signal to get from the Earth to the moon and then back. So maximum 3 second delay. When you're on Mars, it could be a 20 minute or more delay. So you've got to be autonomous. So you've got to be able to build moon bases or build human bases where there's no atmosphere outside that you can live in. And then you've got to be very self-sufficient and not count on people coming to rescue you if things go wrong. So it really is a staging post to Mars. And Mars has got a little bit more promise than the moon. It's a bit colder, but it's got water below the surface. We know that. We've scraped off the dust with spacecraft and seen the water there for ourselves. Front page of a former Astronomy Ireland magazine, some people may remember. And it's got a bit of an atmosphere, which would be difficult to convert to one that the Earth breathes. Probably it would take centuries to millennia to do that. But at least it's got the potential because it's bigger than the moon. And so people think there's more likely to be human bases on Mars. Long term, we could be talking millennia, than there are on the moon, where there's almost no atmosphere. It's a perfect vacuum outside, which has its benefits, but Mars is the long-term goal.
And just on the moon and the, you know, for sustaining humans there for longer than just a visit, it'd be a bit like an international space station based on the moon. Is that really what we're talking about?
Yeah, sort of. I mean, it's floating free in space. You're in microgravity. When you're on the moon, you'll weigh 1/6 of what you weigh on the Earth. So there'd be a bit of gravity there, but not that much, really. You'd be able to do a few superhuman feats if we one day have the huge glass domes that you see in science fiction movies on the moon. But the early bases are likely to be very small, as with anything. And then the scientists at home, there'll be more of those than there are on the moon. And the science, as in the space station, the people on the moon will be conducting experiments for and perhaps in conjunction with the scientists back home. And there'll be a clamor for people who want to do all kinds of science on the moon and indeed just study the moon itself. I mean, we brought back rocks. We know quite a bit about the moon. There's a huge amount of territory there that's as yet unexplored. And the South Pole looks like the place to go because you can get down into deep craters where there could be frozen water, perhaps lying on the surface, easy to use for people and also for fuel. And yet, if you're up on the rim of a crater, you can still catch the sunlight and using solar cells make lots of electricity.
And finally on this part, David, people obviously scratching their heads, and you explained why no one has been there since 1972. Now, I suppose, more to find out what is possible in space because of what's happening to our own Earth. Isn't that right?
Yeah, I mean, the entire environmental movement, this thought, came from that's equivalent to the Artemis II mission coming up in a few weeks, that in 1968, they took a photograph of the Earth rising above the moon. And you can see the Earth is a little marble in space with a very thin atmosphere around it that sustains all human life and all the rest of life on the Earth as well. none on the moon, it's too inhospitable. So protecting that little marble in space became very important in people's lives. And now, of course, the environmental movement is basically governing the future of the human race. What we do with this planet is going to be very important.
Okay.
So it can inspire everything from huge electronics programs to a whole change of lifestyle.
Now, closer to home, David, January is a fantastic month for stargazing, and you're running your annual Jupiter Watch. What makes Jupiter so special right now, and what kind of detail can people expect to see through their telescopes?
Yeah, well, the first thing is, for those who just got the naked eye, Jupiter, you can easily see it's rising over in the east. As soon as it gets dark, you'll see it blazing away. It's 10 times brighter than the brightest stars overhead. So you just can't mistake Jupiter. Occasionally the moon lines up with it. That won't happen till the end of the month. But you don't need the moon to signpost Jupiter. There it is, blazing away. But if you're one of the lucky ones that got a telescope for Christmas, especially a medium to large telescope, do what I've been doing the last few days while Jupiter is closest to Earth all during January. And that's seeing all the cloud belts and the details and the storms within them. I could see the Great Red Spot, a huge storm bigger than the Earth. And you can see other minor little storms. We call them ovals, because they're sort of white things, a fraction the size of the Great Red Spot. Lots of intricate detail in the cloud belts as well. There's always lots to see on Jupiter if you have a good telescope. Now, only 10% of people in astronomy on have big telescopes.
Yeah.
We did a survey once. So even our members don't have telescopes to see this in the majority, and the general public certainly don't. So if you want to see Jupiter live, we run an annual Jupiter Watch when it's closest to Earth. It's happening on Wednesday. Everyone can come along. We're just outside the M52. Easy to get to from any part of the country. 7 o'clock is the time. There's more details on astronomy.id. We can get your tickets, and we'll give you a tea and coffee to keep you warm if it's a cold night as well.
Now, you're also running your annual telescope workshop at the same time. But David, why do so many people struggle with new telescopes, and how valuable is it to get hands-on help rather than relying on instruction manuals?
Yeah, well, suppose you've never seen a smartphone before in your life. And smartphones are a lot more common than telescopes. Imagine the difficulty trying to figure out how to use everything on it. You'd need somebody to teach you, and that's what's sadly missing. And the manuals are, they're okay, but, you know, if you read the manual 10 times over, you still might not know what to do. And we've had people come to us in the past who couldn't even assemble the telescope correctly out of the box, and certainly couldn't figure out how to point it and focus it. Now, if you've got someone who's been around telescopes for decades to show you what to do with your telescope, it's second nature to us. And we can do that for people if you're struggling since you got the telescope at Christmas. You know, you should at least be able to see the moon, Jupiter and its moons, and lots of other things as well. So you can bring the telescope along to the Jupiter Watch, which will double up as the annual Christmas telescope workshop, we call it, and we'll show you how to use it. So if you think of getting a telescope, come and watch us show other people how to use their telescopes, and you'll know there are so many knobs, gear wheels, dials, and everything else on telescope.
Okay.
That it is bamboozling to the beginners.
No doubt. Now, we talked last week about the emergency on board the International Space Station, and the SpaceX thing landed with four astronauts in it there during the week. Now, it will be blazing across our skies this week. What makes it particularly good for spotting, and why is it unusual that only three astronauts are currently on board?
Well, first of all, we'll see it every night this week, blazing across the sky. It was last week we told people, and I've seen it a few times when the skies have been clear. But we normally expect 7 to 10. I think I've seen 11 on the International Space Station in the past. But because of that emergency and the crew of four had to return, NASA won't say which one of the four has the medical problem, and they won't say what the problem is either, because they protect the astronauts' rights to privacy. So they've only got one return vehicle for the four of them. So you can't just send one home, because the three could be stranded if anything goes wrong. So the whole four had to come back. Fortunately, I watched the splashdown live. Dolphins came out to visit them, and everything went perfectly smoothly. The astronauts looked okay, but who knows what kind of medical emergency they had. The first time in the 25 years they've had to do this to bring astronauts back early.
That's right, because I saw them exiting the capsule. I saw them exiting it, and they looked pretty fine to me. But as you say, you just don't know what's going on behind the scenes there in relation to one of them. Anyway.
Yeah, I mean, we can all speculate what it could be, but that's not going to do anybody any good. But it's obviously you know, it's not something that you can visibly see on the astronaut that there's a serious problem. It could be any of the four, and we may never know what it was.
Nor do we need to know, David. But what's the news? The news story in this is that it's the first emergency return from the ISS space station in 25 years, at least. That's what we need to know.
Yeah, and they could do it exactly as they had planned. There have been contingencies for this all along. NASA trains the astronauts to the umpteenth degree for all kinds of eventualities that are probably never going to arise. And the team pulled everything off smoothly.
Yep.
So even if it turns out to be entirely a happy story at the end of the day, and we do wish them luck.
Absolutely.
They prove that side of things works.
Now, later this week, Saturn appears right beside the Moon in the evening sky. For people with no telescope at all, how easy will it be to spot, and why are events like this so helpful for beginners?
Yeah, well, Jupiter is blazing away. You can't miss it, as I said. But Saturn is only as bright as the brightest stars in the sky. So you'll need to know which bright star it is. Now, you could point your telescope at all of the bright stars, and the one with rings will be a dead giveaway that that's Saturn. But the Moon's going to help this weekend. So if you go out on Friday night, as soon as it gets dark, you'll see the Moon, lovely crescent, just below it, the bright star, that's Saturn. Nice diagram in the January issue of Astronomy Island magazine, showing experts with telescopes can actually see Neptune is between Saturn and the Moon, but that's one for the experts. Most of us are just with the naked eye, see the crescent Moon and Saturn just below it. If you've got a telescope, try and see its rings. You might even see its main moon, Titan. I've seen it with even tiny telescopes most astronomers wouldn't bother with. That's how bright Titan is. And with medium to large size telescopes, you can see up to a half a dozen of its moons.
And finally, David, for listeners who catch the astronomy bug after all this, you have astronomy for beginner classes starting next week. What can someone with absolutely no background expect to get out of these classes?
Well, the idea was, you know, we produce a magazine. The idea of a magazine, it's not like a book. You don't read it cover to cover. You dip into the bits that interest you. If something on comets, you read that if you're into comets. If there's something on space flight, humans in space, you might not be interested in comets, but you like astronauts, you read that bit. But some people do actually want to read it cover to cover. They asked us to set up evening classes decades ago to teach them about every aspect of astronomy, from the Big Bang to how to use a telescope and find your way around the sky and everything in between. That's what we do. It's now online. Thousands of people have taken them over the decades. By far the most popular astronomy classes in the country. They're held online so you can watch it from the comfort of your own room anywhere in the country. We are a national organization. And just go to astronomy.ie. You'll see all the topics. You can sign up today. If you're not a member, it doesn't matter. We'll make you a member as part of the fee, and you'll get the magazine then into the future after the classes to keep you informed of all the new discoveries that are being made since the 8 2-hour classes updated you on everything you wanted to know about the universe but were afraid to ask.
So just give us the time and dates for those classes again now.
They're happening on Wednesday week. So in fact, our Jupiter Watch workshop is held exactly 1 week before, just to alert people to the fact that classes are running exactly 1 week after that. So January 21st for the workshop on Jupiter Watch, and January 28th, only a few days away now, for the evening class until the middle of March.
Okay, we leave it there. That was David Moore, editor of Astronomy Ireland magazine. The Telescope Workshop take place this Wednesday, January 21st at 7 p.m. at the Astronomy Ireland near Blanchardstown, with tickets available at astronomy.ie. And don't forget, the classes are a week later on the 28th at 7 p.m. You'll also find...
Don't forget to zip down the bottom of the website for the social media links, because that's where we post the time to see the International Space Station every week. It's already been posted. Look out for that.
Okay, and remember, you're listening to CRKC, the only station in the country bringing you a regular window on the universe. David, thanks very much indeed for joining me, as usual. Okay, that brings us to the end of this evening's program. Stay tuned.